podcasts. The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio with me, Sam Hales. The Profile is brought to you in association with the magazine that I edit. That's Premier Christianity Magazine. If you would like a free sample copy of our latest issue, just head to our website, premierchristianity.com, type your details in, and we would be delighted to send you a free sample copy of our latest issue. But today, right here on Premier Christian Radio, on The Profile, I'm speaking to Mark Sayers. Mark is the senior leader of Red Church in Melbourne, Australia. He's a much sought-after speaker on the intersection of faith and culture, and he's written numerous books on these subjects, including Facing Leviathan, Disappearing Church, Strange Days, and most recently, Reappearing Church, The Hope for Renewal in the Rise of Our Post-Christian Culture. He's also well known for contributing to This Cultural Moment, a podcast he co-hosts with John Mark Comer, who incidentally is a previous guest on this very show. But Mark, it's all about you today. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
So we like to start on this show by going right back to a person's early life and to hear some of their testimony. So tell me a bit about growing up. Did you grow up in Australia?
Yeah, so I grew up in Melbourne. I've lived in the same small part of Melbourne my entire life. My dad came to faith from a Christian family that wasn't Christian. My mum grew up with faith. And so I sort of had an early awareness of faith, but I think I became sort of serious about my faith probably around 16, 17, after a sort of mental health crisis.
Oh, yeah. Wow. So what happened at age 16, 17 to bring that on?
Yeah. So it was a long while before I really understood what was happening, but I became quite badly depressed and really didn't want to go on living. And I actually think that was happening from when I was quite young.
Right.
And it took many years and a number of diagnoses, but basically was struggling with bipolarity. It just had this overwhelming effect on my life in my final year of high school. And sort of got to this breaking point, went and saw a Christian counselor. And I think that's where God really started to break into my life, both in spiritual healing and sort of emotional and mental healing.
This is a topic that more and more people are talking about, I guess, openly now. That's been quite a shift, hasn't it? I think for a long time, it was almost a bit of a taboo subject, even in church. Was that your experience as well?
I think it was a relief. I think at first you it's all new to you, but then when you start to work through understanding it from a medical perspective, one of the things that's been most helpful for me with bipolarity is someone said it's like managing diabetes, and there's something about that just puts it into it's a medical type thing. So I think, there doesn't need to be a stigma there, but sadly there is for many people.
Yeah. So tell me what happened next in your journey.
Yeah. So I sort of began to turn my life around and, my headmaster came to me and said, you're going to, need to drop out at the beginning of my final year. Cause he said, you're never going to finish. He said, Go and work in go and work in the local department store's menswear department. So, I was like, okay. But then I ended up sort of turning things around, finished high school, got into a course, which was hard to get into, advertising, at the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology, and started that and was really interested in that. But God really changed my life when in the holidays, I took a break to go and work in gang affected areas in Los Angeles and San Francisco. That was a month or two before the LA riots, and it was just hardcore. Wow. And God really challenged me in a particular alleyway behind in a sort of projects there. This missionary who was living amongst the poor there just sort of spoke to me about ministry and really kicked my butt. And I came back and it was just God was calling me into ministry. So I went and did an internship with the Salvation Army and ended up being 10 years with the Salvation Army working with them and young people.
I wanted to ask a bit about that because I think when people hear you now wouldn't necessarily guess that you had a Salvation Army background at all. So how did you end up sort of falling into that kind of church? And tell me about that time working inside that particular, denomination, really.
Yeah. So I walked home in high school with everyone, sort of the kids who lived in my area would all walk the same way. And there's a couple of girls who were walking home with, and they just said, why don't you come to our church? My background was Baptist, and I went along to Salvation Army and just made some friends and then just felt connected to what they were doing. So, Yeah, I worked as a youth worker, and we did sort of normal youth ministry stuff, but also a number of stuff with homeless young people. And then I worked sort of downtown, smack bang in the middle of Melbourne. There's a core, as they call churches there. And yeah, so worked with a congregation that was sort of half people living in the city, half homeless people, or people in boarding houses. And so it's a really formational sort of place for me. Yeah, God did a lot for me at that time.
So did that mean kind of giving up the career in advertising?
Yeah, so I gave up advertising. And it's a really interesting field. We should definitely pray for people in those fields. It's interesting because I think a lot of my roots of looking at culture came from advertising, because we were taught, you know, how to look at demographics and culture and stuff like that. So I love that side of it. I think some of the sort of sides where I guess there can be some pliability around ethics, I struggle with a bit more. So sort of those two things of like Salvation Army work and advertising came together in my brain.
So tell me more about what kind of ministry that led into, because 10 years is a long time. I don't know exactly what the ranks are in the Salvation Army, but was there kind of progression through the ranks as well?
Yeah, well, I thought I was going to sort of stay in the Salvation Army for a very long time. But basically the role I was particularly doing ended, and my friend Alan Hirsch and his wife Deborah Hirsch, they heard that role was ending, and they just offered me a job at a church which was called South Melbourne Restoration Community, which is this church doing a lot of really creative things in Melbourne's inner city. So I ended up there, and that church planted the church that I'm part of now. That church no longer exists, but the church that I started came out of there. So that's sort of how that all happened.
And this brings us, of course, to Red Church. I'll ask you about the name Red Church in a minute, but before we get there, I was just looking on your website, and there's this phrase that hits you as soon as you go on the church's website. It's all over the About Us section. And the phrase is "more than me." Yeah. And that's become almost a strapline for the church. I'd love to start with "more than me."
Yeah.
What does that mean? Why is it so prominent in all of... I guess the way you think about what the church is and the way you promote the church.
Well, we actually have it bigger than our sort of like actual church logo. So we flipped that. And we felt really, it just encapsulated what we want to be about. Number one, we live in a time of radical individualism in a city like Melbourne, which is so comfortable. You know, it's often rated the world's most liberal city. It can just be this life story about you. So we wanted to say, hey, there's something bigger than you. It's also this idea of God, that there's something bigger than us. And then that life is about living for more than just yourself. So it's sort of, we call it the name that keeps on giving.
Brilliant. Well, we'll dig into some more of that kind of culture of Melbourne in a minute, but also the name Red. Why Red Church is quite an unusual name.
So basically, the church, South Melbourne, went through a sort of change. It became Red, and we sold our building and split into four sites or services or congregations around Melbourne, northeast, southwest. And we were trying to think of a new name. One of the guys was a Spanish speaker, and he said that in Spanish, net or network or net equals, so it was like a network, like a net is red. So that's how the origins of the name began. But it's continually confusing. Every newcomer's event, the first question, what does Red mean? The paper rang me up, and in one of the broadsheets in Melbourne said, you know, are you a socialist church? So everyone gets it. Yeah, gets it wrong.
But you've never changed the name?
No. We just kept it. It's,
I guess it's a talking point, if nothing else.
Yeah, it's a good colour. And
so tell me about that process, I guess, of kind of becoming a church planter, I suppose, church leadership, the call into that and what that looked like for you.
Yeah, it was a very direct call, like to particularly that church as well. So the church was going through a really difficult time. So we were the only surviving of those services. So a church planting would have been easy in comparison. So it was really a turnaround of a church that had tried something quite innovative and creative and hadn't worked as we thought. So I reckon it took about 7 years to turn it around. I don't know what to call myself, a church planter, a church replenisher, I'm not sure.
I was reading before you've spoken about how you've been involved in church plants that have failed. And we don't often hear about that. We hear a lot of success stories, which is great. And we want to hear the good news stories, but we want to be realistic as well of what goes wrong and what are the dangers, what are the kind of lessons you learned from those difficult periods of things not working out as you thought they would.
It's very humbling in that Yeah, there's many lessons. Number one is that often something that you can see working somewhere else doesn't mean it's going to work where you are.
Right.
So often you can see something that's happening in America or somewhere and you're like, let's just copy that. But there's very unique realities to context and the people you're dealing with. Mm. Also, church plants can take on forms at different stages. So often you can start with the planting team, but then very much they're your biggest assets, but then they can also be resistors to the next change. So often churches in the early stages attract people who want it to be small or don't want it to grow. Yeah. So there's that challenges. There's the challenge of having to do everything yourself so often. People don't realize a large percentage of church plants don't succeed. And God taught me so much of what not to do. I feel like the first part of my ministry life was what not to do lessons, which has been good now, hard at the time.
Yeah. So when exactly was this happening? The church parts didn't work out. Was this Salvation Army thing or was this later on?
Yeah. So I did a sort of congregation plant when I was in Salvation Army and aimed at young people. So we were a traditional Salvation Army corps and they were great in that they let me do this thing. And it was very sort of innovative. And it started well, but then it just struggled and sort of passed away. And then we tried a new thing again in the downtown. And again, similar story. And then I tried another plant in the area that I was living out of South Melbourne, which was where I was at. And that also failed. So all of them, there's points where there was things that I was doing wrong, but also that I felt I needed to change. Mm-hmm. I began to realize that leadership is, one of my mantras, which I got from my mentor, Terry Walling, is that, personal renewal leads to corporate change. Mm-hmm. And I needed to go on a personal renewal. That ministry is an overflow of what's already happening inside mm-hmm. of you. And I think early on I was seeing what it was about what's outside of me.
Yeah. Well, tell me a bit about the culture of Melbourne, your city, where you've grown up and where you've ministered and... what's it like? As for someone who, sadly myself, I've never been to Australia, I'd really love to go. What's it like? How does it compare to somewhere like the UK?
Yeah, I think probably Melbourne is quite different to Sydney and different to a lot of people's impressions overseas of what Australia's like. So I'd say Melbourne feels a bit more European. Sydney was started as a convict colony, so it sort of was a bit ramshackle, where Melbourne was a planned city, and actually, interestingly, the first governor was Moravian from London. So it interestingly has a lot of parks and a lot of public facilities where there was like, how do we build a city that's not like the British Industrial Revolution or the worst of it? It has a lot of very English feel to it, but it's also very multicultural. I think just under 50% of people are born overseas, and then a large percentage have a parent born overseas. It's a very Asian city increasingly, very Chinese city, Vietnamese, Cambodian, but also the world's biggest Greek city outside of Greece. My state, I think 1 in 4 people have Italian heritage. So you've very got a cafe culture sort of thing. It's sort of quite a creative city and it's growing extremely fast. So we'll overtake Sydney. So I think we're just under 5 million now. It's also a bit like LA in that it's very spread out, so it's quite big as mm-hmm. well. I find it a very intellectual city, sometimes a very cynical city that can be hard for churches. You sort of got to convince people and people sort of cross their arms and sit back and look at you. But it's so beautiful. There's so many things happening in the city. It's a sport-obsessed city. One of the most difficult things is that every weekend there's several world-class sporting events, several music festivals, several arts. There's just food. Well, most restaurants per capita in the world, countless cafes. So you're always competing against that,
wow.
You feel.
Wow. That's a really thorough appraisal of where you live. And I imagine there's a challenge there, although you've not said this. I'm thinking, is there a challenge there for church leaders? How well do you know your local area? Can you list off those things that you've listed about your local area? And of course, this all begs the question of, with all that in mind, how does that then affect the way you do church, the way you do evangelism?
Yeah. So we found that, we have to engage people both with the head and the heart. People in Melbourne I find, particularly where we are in our area, they want to find a Christianity that's intellectually credible. They want it to speak into the culture. But then there's also this deep heart need in an intellectual city. Someone said Sydney's a body city. It's the beach and it's body beautiful. Melbourne's lived in cafes and galleries and thinking.
Right.
So you've got to engage that. But then I just find this, it's almost like once you get past that, there's this deep anxiety in people, which I think is all over the place now. Yeah. But
you told this story actually that I thought was quite touching. I wanted to talk about it, of your church being graffitied just before Easter Sunday a couple of years ago, but how actually that experience led to another church kind of rallying around and led to some unity. Tell us that story.
Well, I think I was going through this stage where it just felt. I knew so many people who were losing their faith in Melbourne, and I'd had a number of conversations with young adults who come to church, and they were the last one of their friendship group sort of still in faith. We also had a number of people with quite serious, I would almost say bullying at work over their faith, like not just the usual jokes. I mean, like full-blown people walking up to them and sort of questioning, you know, how can they almost be in the public sphere being a Christian? So I just felt like this incredible pressure. We got to Easter Sunday and we have a big combined service, and that finishes and like we have holidays after that. So 2 weeks of holidays. So like everyone's sort of dismissed. I was flying out to the US the next day and had left a book at my office I wanted to read on the plane, and got around to our offices, and I come around the corner sort of tired, hurried. Big weekend, we have like this big Passover meal, we then have Good Friday, Easter Sunday, all the services, exhausted, and pull around the corner and just across the front of our church I can just see this giant sheet and then the words "off God," and I'm like, oh my goodness, what is this? And I look,
you can imagine what the sheet might be covering.
I was hoping, but no. And I lift it off, and you know, there's the F-bomb there, and it just was this sense like someone's done this on Saturday night for Easter Sunday. This isn't just, it was too random. It wasn't, you know, it was too planned, you know.
Yeah.
And I just, like, my heart sank, and it felt like there was this tremendous pressure just coming from the culture that had just ratcheted up. And I just, like, grabbed my phone. Who do I call? I thought, oh, my staff have all disappeared. And then I thought, who's a really helpful volunteer? You've always got one in church who'd be, like, happy to paint it off the wall. And then I just felt like God say, No, I want you to paint it. I then sort of noticed that someone had left this note at the bottom, and it was this just typed letter from across the road. There's a Catholic parish and a Catholic school, and it was just this note from the father there, and it just basically said, you know, "Hi, Red Church, we're really sorry that this has greeted you this Easter morning. We spent, you know, I think they were there for like 6 a.m. mass or something. You know, the people had come out and they'd all sat on chairs and tried to scrub it off.
Wow.
And then all they could do was put this sheet across it and, you know, wishing us a really wonderful Easter. And it just changed it. It reframed it for me. My wife's family are from Northern Ireland, and both her parents were born in Belfast. And you understand the sectarianism that happened there and how Christians fought over Catholicism and Protestantism. And then I just had this beautiful image in my head of these Catholics coming and serving our church, which is Protestant, you know, on chairs trying to scrub this off. And I just thought, how weird, like this moment of sort of anti-Christian sentiment has actually brought this moment of Christian unity. So I spent the rest of the sort of afternoon painting this thing, and it was really weird. It was like I'd been so running around and harried that it was like this focal activity where I'm just like focusing and painting, and then it like calmed me down, and then it was like a blank slate, and I felt like God saying, what if at this moment of intense post-Christian pressure, actually there's this blank slate I'm creating for you? And that moment reframed, and that's really where the genesis of my book Reappearing Church came from. Like, what if this could be our best moment?
That brings us nicely on to the pressure that I think a lot of church leaders I know are feeling in this country, and indeed around the world in I guess what's been dubbed the secular West, where it feels like every statistic that comes out every week, every month, is showing less and less people going to church, less and less people identifying as Christians. And it almost feels like some parts of the church are just on catch up with this, because this isn't necessarily that new a trend. And yet I think we're all still trying to figure out how do we deal with this. And this brings us on to a lot of your work and looking at culture. So the question I wanted to start out with is secularism dead?
secularism is creating problems. It took the high ground. And what's really interesting is when you're an insurgent force and you're not in the high ground, all you can do is you just have to attack. It's quite easy. It's like you're a guerrilla. You just attack the convoy. But then when you're in power, you're the convoy. And, you know, when you're an occupying force, the amount of troops, you know, like in the Iraq war, the General Petraeus famously asked for a troop surge just to have people to stop against these insurgents. And in many ways, that I think what's happening is secularism is now experiencing its own problems of holding that high ground. It's got to enforce its own morality. It has to defend the ground. The fact that people now, interestingly, talk about, you know, these sort of things around faith should be gotten rid of presumes that they have the power to do that. And I think what we're experiencing now, and it's happening in real time, is that there's an increased meaning gap that people thought would go away.
Right.
So I think a lot of the return to people interested in nationalism, tribalism, identity, all of this is a hunger for meaning that secularism has created.
Yes, and secularism couldn't provide.
Exactly.
Hence, is this idea of secularism actually on the way out? And if so, what's going to replace it?
Well, I mean, I think there's also different understandings of secularism. There was an early, you know, understanding, which was, let's just keep it out of the public sphere, go and do your thing in your private world. But then I think there was this new element of secularism which wants to define where we're going, define what utopia will be. There's an almost an element. I feel like the church is now pushed to the side, but that's actually not as bad a place we think. I think the church has always been at the side. And I think Christians need to reframe that a lot of what is burning up is actually not genuinely held faith.
Right.
It's actually cultural Christianity. And if you look at Victorian Britain, you know, you could say it is a Christian place, but really it was a very, you know, Victorian Britain had held a sort of thin veneer of cultural Christianity, which looked down on people who took their faith seriously.
Yeah, it's really interesting because you do sometimes hear Christians in this country talk about, well, we used to be a Christian country and kind of, you know, church attendance was so much, you know, so many more people were going to church and we had Christian laws. And there is a narrative that says, well, we've lost all of that now and now we've become secular. If I'm hearing you right, though, you're saying, well, actually, was a lot of that true Christianity or was it just culture?
And exactly. And if you do look at it, I mean, I think there's, I call it the crude street level view of secularism, which sort of the average punter on the street believes that, who knows, was it 1200? Everyone went to church and slowly dropped off or maybe hit the Enlightenment and cratered. If you look at it, there was periods, you know, the 14th century had a return to faith around the plagues and you know, there was another one in the 18th century. There are these renewal, revival movements. So it's much more like a sort of a roller coaster. And, you know, in 1900, people were predicting that, you know, faith would completely disappear. It has an incredible resilient way of coming back. The other thing to say about it too is that one of the things that the last couple of years have told us is don't just listen to the elites who control the controlling narratives of the culture, who didn't see Brexit happening, who didn't see Trump happening, that some of the people now who live in echo chambers online are actually the worst people to read the culture. Go out on the street, particularly talking in multi-ethnic communities. There's incredibly vibrant reality. So Jonathan Sacks has a great statement. He says, we're getting less religious and more religious all at the same time.
The more religious aspect, though, help us understand that. Because again, the polls would suggest we're becoming less religious and less religious in the sense that if you look at the polls, certainly in this country, there doesn't seem to be any obvious signs of church growth. I mean, I have heard some Christian leaders claim that and say, no, there are green shoots sprouting and there is real, you know, church plants are working and all that stuff, but it's not currently reflected on the big picture statistics. And if you look at the big picture, it does look like a downward trend.
Søren Kierkegaard wrote a really interesting book called The Present Age. And in it, he attacked a tendency that was emerging in the West, which now is everywhere. And that's the concept of the public. And we talk about the public as if it's a person who rocks around with one set idea in their head. And, you know, the reality of the public is so broad. I often will sit at my office, I can see the street, and I'll just watch who goes by. And oh, there's a Iranian guy, and there's a Vietnamese Australian mum, and there's a white businessman. Like, and I'm going, they all think different things. And sometimes they think different things at different times of the day. You know, there's evidence now in America that more people believe in UFOs than are atheists. And, you know, so that sort of statistics aren't spoken about. So I actually think this we've bought this myth that Christian renewal looks like the public changing their mind.
Right.
It's never looked like that. Mm. The church has always been a healing, creative minority. Mm. The end of sort of, you know, revelation isn't when public relations gurus in the church get 87% of people on earth believing in Christ. It's actually about the church showing the kingdom of God and being faithful to Christ's mandate and message for them.
Yeah. So it's almost as if we're asking the wrong questions.
Yes.
And expecting something that God never said would happen for us, for our cultures, for our nations.
Exactly.
You have this great phrase that I've used before. I've quoted you before on this when talking about some of these topics, about how society wants the kingdom without the king.
Yes.
Wants the things of God without acknowledging God as great. Can you unpack some more of that and explain some more of what you mean by that phrase?
Well, I mean, almost everything that you do, like, one of the ways that it's helpful to look at the world is that the world is driven by post-Christianity. Now, often we can use that term, like, post-Christianity is like people move past the church. A lot of it, our ideas of justice, of equality, of even moving to a future better place, of some sort of perfect society or improving society, so many of them are Christian. So many people out there are speaking in Christian terms and Christian language, but they don't realize it. You know, you just have to go to other parts of the world which doesn't have that, where someone who is homeless or injured, that's actually because of the karmic cycle. We're like, oh, okay. So, you know, so a lot of what the West wants is actually a Christian vision, but without the king. So we want it, but we want to achieve it under the power of human strength.
You're listening to Premier Christian Radio with me, Sam Hales. You've joined us for The Profile, and I'm in conversation today with the cultural commentator, Mark Sayers. You can hear the rest of our conversation right after this.
Join me, Justin Briley, for a new season of The Big Conversation with world-class thinkers, including Sir Roger Penrose and William Lane Craig on God and the Universe, Bart Ehrman and Peter J. Williams on Jesus and the Gospels. Join the conversation as we explore life's biggest questions at thebigconversation.show.
Premier Christianity Magazine.
Are you fed up with fake news or bored of bad stories? We think it's time for something different. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. Every month, our team publishes stories of lives transformed, testimonies, miracles, healings, and loads more good news. We're here to encourage you, excite you, and keep you up to date with all that God is doing through His church. That's why we're proud to bring you a magazine that's different.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio with me, Sam Hales. My guest on the show today is the cultural commentator and pastor from Australia, Mark Sayers. Mark is perhaps best known for being on This Cultural Moment, a very popular podcast that he co-hosts with John Mark Comer, who's a pastor based out in Portland in the USA. And John Mark Comer was a previous guest on this show. You can find that in the Profile podcast archive. Just go to premierchristianradio.com/theprofile. All the details are there for how to get The Profile as a podcast. But time now to rejoin my conversation with Mark Sayers. I know you've been on a bit of a journey with this idea of cultural relevance. Mm. I think even in some of the sort of church context you've worked in, You've gone all out, sort of, you know, pursuing relevance, I guess, as an idea. And I know that's an idea you've kind of rethought. Can you take us through some of your own personal journey with that idea of cultural relevance, of the way to reach culture is to be relevant in the way we do church?
Yeah, I think particularly, you know, in the United States, you had a movement where you had returning missionaries coming back to the United States who realized that there was an increasing cultural gap between what was happening in the general public and, there, I just used the word public, what was happening in American culture and what was happening in the church. And so they had used these forms of cross-cultural communication, finding things in the culture which are relevant as a way of communicating the gospel. And so they then adopted that to American Christian life. And I think there was a lot of good in that. But then almost the danger was that it became this idea that what you needed to do was make the reason people aren't becoming Christian is church is not cool enough or culturally relevant enough. And cool and culturally relevant have become intertwined in the popular imagination. You look at ads for health funds, and it's cool people. Like, what I always find is interesting is increasingly diverse, which is great, but everyone's still cool. It's like every type of person, but still young and hip. And so there's this concept that if we could just make the message of Christianity cool and hip, then revival will break out.
Right.
And it's just simply doesn't work.
Right. And you have personal experience of this?
Totally. I mean, I'll never forget. We were just pushing into this so hard. I did a church in a cafe. We do all these crazy art installations, mention stuff. And I remember we did this thing one day, and this non-Christian guy just came and he goes, "Yeah, look, not for me. It doesn't feel like church." And I realized that there's a definite sense of the sacred in people's minds. Like, in a sense, Christendom's a little bit like Hamlet's ghost. It may be dead, but it's still acting in the play. And I think that actually what people are looking for is authenticity. People are looking for a sense of the sacred. People are actually looking for an encounter with God, and we're giving them relevance. We're getting to a point where people are now overdosing on cool. Everything in Melbourne is cool. Everything is stylized and has this Instagram hipster aesthetic, and people are just over it.
Yeah, it's almost we've gone so far into that Instagram culture that I guess you're saying some of us have hit a bit of a peak and are just choosing to switch off from all that stuff. So that concept of the sacred is really interesting, because you think, with a light show and a smoke machine, people walk in and they see that and they feel like that cuts against what they're looking for in some kind of holy moment.
I mean, Alan de Botton wrote, a book, Religion for Atheists, and in it, he talks about the value of churches. There's the Assembly here in London, which is, it's a church for atheists.
Right, exactly.
And they're almost saying,
Sunday Assembly, they call it.
Yeah, we want all that stuff which you guys are wanting to throw at. We just want it without God. And so there's actually, at different times, particularly if you look at English culture, there was moments of renewal came when there was a great social change, people were socially dislocated, and the church stepped into that gap, creating mediating institutions in which people found Christ. I think we're approaching a digital version of that. So we're going, the world is overdosing on digital. I think we're approaching a possible digital recession, a breakup of social media giants, people switching off because they're just anxious. Like, there's an element where it was fun at the beginning, but now it's like anxious inducing. So there's an opportunity for the church to reconnect people to community, authenticity, humanness.
You talked before about this idea of kind of anxiety being driven by two ends. I think I saw a graph that you put up on social media. It was sort of in the middle. It was like anxiety and stress, and I think digital was on one side.
Yes.
And I can't remember. You unpack the analogy for
us. Well, I mean, what a lot of people don't realize, we're in an incredibly polarized political moment. But what I've realized is that I think what people haven't seen is that there's a tremendous coming together. It's almost like we have mutant versions of left and right. The mutant version of the left is you can just be who you want to be, break all taboos, you can, anyone who tells your identity is wrong, you can push back against that. The right has come up with a mutant form of capitalism, which completely disembeds you, which now tracks us. There's a term people are using, surveillance capitalism, where Google knows you better than you know yourself.
This is the whole digital capitalism idea.
Yes.
I think I found an example of this this morning, actually. Mm. There's a food delivery takeaway company, and it was turned out that they had, when you put your postcode in to this company, offer you all kinds of different takeaways. If you put a postcode in where the algorithm knows that that's a part of the country where a lot of people are overweight, it will advertise fried chicken to you.
Yes.
And if you put in a postcode from a more affluent area where people are more healthy, they'll advertise sushi to you.
Yes. It's so true. And what that's doing is creating both of those things come together. So actually think, I saw it, was in San Francisco last month or something, and flying out from the airport, and there's Uber Eats for marijuana.
Oh my word.
It's some new app, and it's like, I saw that, and I just thought, oh my goodness, that would be the end of some people. I thought Uber Eats McDonald's was bad enough. But, Japan had the concept of the hikikomori, which were these people who went into isolation in their own homes and never left their rooms. And you're seeing that come to the West now, and there's a point where there's an end to that. That doesn't just keep happening without some kind of backlash.
So does this have relevance, again, bring it back to church, for emphasizing community and discipleship and moving away from technology and saying, as a church, you will be in a kind of a discipleship relationship where we actually talk to each other and where there is a real community? And, and is that what you think people, young people, are going to be craving more and more because the digital promise of being connected to people has failed?
Yeah. I mean, often we think about people coming into a church and sort of, here's a knowledge of Christ. There's an assumption that they've got some basic functionalities in their lives. You know, maybe 30, 40 years ago, that's what we thought. Then we realized there's a group of people coming in who are broken. Maybe they had substance abuse, mental health challenge or whatever. But now I would say it's overwhelmingly 90 plus people need formation, particularly in younger generations. Many struggle to have a conversation, overwhelmed with social anxiety. The stats for Australia and the US are less and less young people are having sex because you actually have to be in a room with someone to have sex. And they don't know how to meet people from the opposite, you know, sex. They don't know how to meet partners, whatever. They don't know how to get a job. You know, there's this whole concept of adulting now, like this stress around, I've got to pay a bill. So I think there's a place for the church to offer formational life skills as part of the discipleship journey. So it's almost like we get to, you know, help people rebuild from the bottom up.
Wow. I wanted to talk about one of the biggest issues, cultural issues, really facing the church at the moment, certainly the church in the West, and that's around how the church responds to LGBT, to gay people, to transgender people. Because often Christians are there's this sort of picture in the media of the Christian community and the LGBT community are kind of at war with one another. If you read a lot of the news stories, that seems to be the narrative. And I think a lot of church leaders have been tempted just to kind of back away from the issue entirely. And so you'll find a number of prominent evangelical churches in this country, if you go on their websites, listen to their sermons, there'll be no mention whatsoever. And there's a fear, I think, of being misunderstood. There is a fear of, what if a journalist hears this and next thing you know, we're on the front page of our local newspaper. Is kind of backing away from that conversation of, you know, as a kind of part, because you're a pastor, just sort of not going there. Do you think that's a viable option?
I think it's really interesting in the sense that many churches see their frontage in the digital space, when in reality our frontage is actually with people. I had an experience about a year ago where I was on Monday, I had my kids and they're at primary school, so I picked them up and I was a bit early, so I was looking at Twitter, walking to school, and it was just polarization, people calling each other out, and it was just stressful. So I turned it off, walked into the primary school, and it was just like, there were people saying, Australia is polarized, you know, blah, blah, blah. And there was this mum that came in with a new baby. And all of a sudden, these mothers gathered around her. And one mother was like tattoos, you know, like everywhere. This other mother came in. She's wearing Islamic headdress, scarf rather. Another mum sort of in her fitness gear. And they're all just talking. And I was like, this is the real world. So I think that one of the dangers is that we can just look at this as a public relations exercise. And I get that because there's call-out culture everywhere. I literally was just looking at Twitter, walking here, and there's a new Australian football team being launched, and they put up their logo, which is a bull, the MacArthur Bulls in Western Sydney. And straight away, this is a toxic masculine symbol. You know, so straight, like, and they were trying to put this whole thing, like, we're an inclusive, diverse club, and straight away you smack down. So there's this element that whatever you do will be criticized by people. But I think it's important for churches to realize that essentially this is about humans, and it's not something which is out there. It's actually something that's in there. So I can understand that churches can be in that place, particularly if you're a public church. You know, you're already seeing, say, we've got an election campaign at the moment. We have a Christian prime minister.
Yes, this was in the news, wasn't it? Because it was just the other day, I understand there's effectively two Christians running for public office, a Catholic and evangelical, and didn't this particular issue of gay marriage come up in the middle of a TV debate of the more liberal voice calling out the more conservative voice, but both of them Christians on this issue. So it's dividing Christians as much as anyone else.
Yeah, so we have Israel Folau, who the rugby player, who goes to quite a conservative Samoan church.
Yeah.
And he put up the verse around homosexuality, and it's just been an absolute bonfire. But it's also interesting that there's multiple layers. I think that's there's we have to understand that the digital age wants to put everything into binaries, that you can make a decision right. like that. And with that, there's so many complexities. I think you did it in a poor way. Brian Houston wrote a response about that. And Simon Smart did a good one in the Sydney Morning Herald, responding to that, coming from a position which would, you know, I guess be conservative on the issue, but saying there's a different way of doing that. But then there is religious freedom issues. There's all kinds of these issues, floating around. So it's incredibly complex.
On balance, though, for yourself as a pastor, you have to sort of make a call on this sort of stuff. Would you find yourself erring with those who would address this in public, or would you have more sympathies with those who say, look, this particular subject, because it involves, you know, people's lives, we should just do this in private?
We'll publicly talk about it, but also realise, you know, how to do that in a really well way. But then there's just the pastoral reality that you're dealing with it as well.
Well, we've talked a lot about secularism and how we define that, and is this church decline, you know, how do we understand that? Well, I want to take a bit more of an international look at this, because we know that China, for example, Christianity is growing at an incredible rate. We know there's more Christians there, the members of the Communist Party now. And it's not just China, other places around the world where, you know, think of places like South America, where it seems like revivals break out in other parts of the world. What ramifications do you think that will have for the way we think about Christianity and the global church and all the things we've just been discussing?
Well, reading a bit about this, there's a really interesting trend at play, that if you are someone who holds to that secularist view, so for example, in Australia, if you look at our sort of hipsterish professional suburbs, let's call them that, in the inner city of Melbourne and Sydney, their birth rate is absolutely in the negative. If you go out to Western Sydney, you'll find a really high birth rate. And it's really interesting, the more religiously inclined people are and more serious about the faith, the more babies they have. Right. This is just sociological reality. So what's really interesting is this particular highly individualized life script of secularism basically destroys itself in one generation. And there was a really interesting article in one of our papers, I think it was the Herald Sun, and what they found is that it was basically not millennials are like you think. And basically what they said was that when we think of millennials, we're actually thinking of primarily urban educated millennials. When actually Chinese-born and African-born and Asian-born millennials in Australia, particularly in the Asian-born, Indian and Chinese, which are our biggest two migrant groups, they're more religious, they are better educated, they have more children, they marry younger, they're more religious, they vote conservative on social issues. So you can already see where that trend is going to go. And one of the really interesting things is that, you know, there's so many people at the moment pushing back from conservatism against migration. But an argument could be made that the best thing for social conservatism is actually more migration.
I mean, it's a point that people don't always acknowledge. I mean, it has been interesting, again, to bring it back to something we were talking about earlier with the LGBT issues, where some Christians have felt like we're being really attacked for our traditional views on this. And yet, for example, it feels like that some Muslim communities or even Jewish communities almost get a bit of a free pass on this, and something quite odd going on, they would argue, with parts of the more kind of liberal media where this is used as a stick to beat certain groups of people. I'd love to get your take on that. I mean, I heard someone say recently that, oh yes, if you're a Catholic and you're a prominent Catholic, you will be asked by a secular journalist about abortion. If you're an evangelical, you will be asked about gay marriage. And how the media can almost be guilty, like you say, of pigeonholing people in certain areas and saying, well, we'll beat you with this stick because you identify as this kind of a person.
Yeah, I think that's changing. In Australia, we had a marriage plebiscite, so a referendum.
Plebiscite, like, is a great word.
Plebiscite, and not often used.
A referendum.
A referendum, okay. But there's a difference between a plebiscite and a referendum.
Oh, okay.
I'm not even going to pretend I understand the difference. And what was really interesting is that gay marriage was passed in Australia, but the area was Western Sydney, which is our most multicultural that it didn't pass.
Right.
It's an area with very few white people, or, you know, there's white working class, but predominantly African, yep. Filipino, Vietnamese, everything. And I saw it trending on Twitter, and very quickly I saw the left going after Islam on that.
Right.
In Europe, it's been really interesting how this cause has been taken up. You know, people like Geert Wilders, the Pimfontaine, who was assassinated, the Front National, Marine Le Pen, are using this. So the average, I think the average voter for a far-right party in Holland is actually a gay man in their 60s, is the demographic. So I think you're seeing that changing. There's a fascinating conversation happening within Islam, particularly in America at the moment. And there's a big pushback against the concept of Islamophobia and the concept of identity politics within Muslim communities, because they're seeing that what's actually happening is that it's actually then, in a sense, emptying the content. So like they just had, Sports Illustrated just had their swimsuit edition. There was a woman in a burkini. And it was fascinating watching the conversation within the Islamic community and people saying, this is not what the hijab's about. It's actually about modesty. Yeah. So it's like, we'll take an identity element of it, but we'll empty of its content, which has been happening for Christianity for ages. So I think that's beginning to change with Islam.
Well, one of the fascinating people who's come up in this kind of world for commentating on identity politics and even religion is, of course, Jordan B. Peterson.
Yes.
And he's a really fascinating character who's divided Christians a little bit. I mean, some Christians are a big fan of him, think he's more friend than foe. Others have big issues with him. What's your take on someone like him? Because he's attracted a huge following. I'd be interested to know from your perspective as a pastor if he is more of a friend than he is a foe.
I mean, it's a phenomenon. So there's multiple layers. Number one, I am absolutely shocked how many people are secretly listening to him. I know people, one of the weirdest pastoral things that is happening that I never thought would have happened is conversations we're having and my staff had with people where basically they're saying, I've secretly lost my faith in my progressivism and I don't know what to do and I can't tell anyone about it. So fascinating. And, you know, it was sort of like, it seemed like 10 years ago, the conversation was like, oh, I've lost my faith in evangelicalism. Now it's actually flipping. Really? So interesting. Huh. So you're just, and I know multiple people who secretly are not telling anyone, but heavily listening to it. So I think there's an element that, there's multiple elements to him. I think one, he is, his message of, here's how you order your life, particularly for a lot of younger people. Now, a lot of people have said actually, he's appealing to a lot of white young men. I'm actually finding that's not the case. Multiple females, multiple different people who are not white, fully into him. So fascinating. So just impersonal. And I know people have been to his events that it's not what you think. But what he's appealing is to people who have been told nothing about how to live a life. So clean your room is just resonating with a generation who are deformed in formational patterns. Number two, I think the pushback on political correctness, the statistics tell us, like the one that just came out of the States, is that you've got a small percentage of right-wing identity politics people, a small percentage of left-wing identity politics people, and in the middle they're called the exhausted majority. Someone said Jordan Peterson is a ventriloquist for what most people are thinking but are afraid they don't want to say it because they get shot down. Then thirdly, he's sort of an interesting Jungian Christian who would have not been out of place in a mainstream liberalish denomination 40 years ago.
Right.
But for a lot of people who are hungering for a sense of myth and meaning, and Jung, you know, someone in the mid-century, in the wake of a lot of sort of demythologizing, introduced people back to mythology. So he's definitely connecting with a lot of people. I was speaking to a guy recently who started going to Facebook meetups and was meeting multiple people who'd become Christians through Jordan Peterson and never been to church.
Wow. Now, it's time to talk about revival, because, of course, your latest book is on that topic. Yeah, just to provide a bit of context to this, revival is something that was talked about in the UK church in evangelical circles a lot in the 80s and 90s, and there was this narrative that the church is being restored and we've rediscovered the things of the Spirit, and really the church is going to be triumphant, ultimately. And, of course, that hasn't happened. We've not seen revival, certainly, in the way it was predicted, in the way it was spoken about back then. So I think some people are perhaps a little bit disillusioned immediately as soon as they hear the word revival. But I guess two questions to start with. First of all, what are you meaning by revival? And what are your thoughts as you look at culture, look at the West, and, you know, why are you writing a book on such a huge topic now?
Well, I was probably more cynical than most people. And I had a very well-formed critique of it. The word I use is renewal. I say revival is renewal gone viral. But as I began to study churches...
Just to interrupt on that, renewal gone viral is an interesting way of phrasing it, because, again, applying it to what happened in the 80s and 90s, you could make an argument there was church renewal in the 80s and 90s, and there wasn't the hope for revival. So yes. So renewal didn't go viral then.
Yes, right. Yes, exactly. So when you actually look at, I think, how faith genuinely operates, as we were talking about before, of like in a roller coaster, James Burns wrote a book, I think in 1900 around then, where he said it's like faith is like a tide that goes in and out. And just when it seems to have gone out, it comes back with force. And I think for me, it was twofold. One, it was looking at it sort of sociologically, mm-hmm. And looking at moments of high globalization, high social dislocation, a meaning recession, faith tends to come back. The second thing I realized there was almost this myth coming in the church, which I was very much part of, that if we just educate everyone enough, if we just get smart enough, that that's what's going to do it. But when I read scripture, it's actually when people turn back to God, don't try and do it in their own strength. So I see the renewal posture as one that needs to be always taken, and we always need to be renewed, and that begins with ourselves. The concept of scripture has this idea of God's presence returning to our living temple, which is us, to the temple, which is the church in the New Testament, and to the temple, which is the world. So I just have this sense that there are a lot of people getting to this point where what's coming against us, we're actually not going to be able to turn around with just being smarter, that actually we need to cry out for God to move. Leslie Newbegin had a really interesting view of secularism. He believed that secularism was something which came against all belief and shook any foundations of authority and left humans only being able to rely on the foundation of God. And I feel like we're part of that. Everything from Me Too to Brexit to political scandals to FIFA corruption, you know, whatever you put your hope on, environmentalism,
that there is this shaking of the world where people desperately want a better world. So I see in that people are looking for renewals, and
Christians have a part to play in looking for renewals. We can't stay on the sidelines of that.
So are you then, because of all that, hopeful about the next 5 years, 10 years? I mean, I imagine not the sort of person who wants to put a date prediction on these things, but nevertheless, you are writing about a topic that,
yes,
you know, people were saying, well, is this going to happen?
Yes. Xanthi, who's a really sharp young woman in my congregation, came up to me after I preached on this and said, Mark, are you saying as a prophet that there's going to be a revival, or are you saying someone who reads church history, what do you see? And I'm seeing it as someone who reads church history, mm-hmm. that I believe that we're coming to a point which we need to be very attentive of. I think the business as usual for the last 30 years has changed. There's something here to be grasped. So I believe that you should always take up a position of renewal or preparing for renewal. I am totally prepared that I could just be the preparer, you know, be a preparer, not the preparer, I'm not messianic complex here, that one of many people preparing for what God wants to do next. Yeah. And that could be my daughter's generation, my son's generation, could be in 50 years time. When you study renewal, you see these are very long, long things. Some of them played over a century. But I do pray and hope that God will move. And I do have this sense, I don't want to say that like some prophetic word said on the radio, but I do have this sense as I'm speaking to people and I'm hearing commonalities. And what I'm finding interesting is translocational. Having conversations with people all around the world that are feeling and sensing similar things. So it's really interesting.
So what does preparing for a renewal look like practically? What would you encourage people to do?
Pray, number one. Every renewal is birthed in prayer. Secondly, repentance. That I believe that part of coming out of that relevance period was like also coming out of a lot of compromise with the world. And in particular, the dominant mythologies and idols of the West. And particularly a lot of us at the cultural interface between church and culture find ourselves bridging two worlds and coming back to what is actually the kingdom's values and a heart for the kingdom. Mm-hmm. And a posture shift from one of consuming, which I think defined culture and thus the church of religious consumption, to one of actually contending for God to move.
Mm-hmm. Christians, we like to think of ourselves as being countercultural. That's what we're called to do. But I guess because this thing of culture is so pervasive, it is, you know, we might go to church on a Sunday or a small group in midweek and hear, you know, the truth, and we might have our quiet time in the morning. But even if we do all of that, most of what we're living in is a culture that does not share our values or our perception of the kingdom. And so I guess it's very easy to take on the culture's ideas and values without even necessarily realizing it, when like we're saying, we're called to live in a countercultural way. So what are some of those areas of, I guess, of concern that you've seen in the West where Christians are taking on ideas from the culture that aren't of God?
So I think it's really worth marking a tremendous shift that I think has even happened just in the last 2 years. So before then, you had this motif in the West, you start with the Enlightenment onwards, of like, the church is sort of uptight and moral, and the culture's libertarian and, you know, party on or go to church. That's completely changed. Increasingly, we have a highly moral cultural order, which is imposing itself. So that's really interesting, number one. Number two, what is even more all-embracing is that it's not now, will you be influenced by the world? It is now that corporations and big tech are fully influencing your life and will program you and extract data from you, and you are now their slave. Do you want to live like that? Now, that sounds extreme. I mean, I'm reading the massive tome by Shoshana Zuboff, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, and it's incredible how much the plans for us to be... data, we're just giving it away. Our life patterns now, what is 99% of the people listening do when they wake up? They check their phone.
Yeah.
They respond to certain news articles that elicit an emotion from them. You are being harvested for your emotions. So I see it now, we're flipping from like, there's the cool people outside the church who want to have fun. No, it's not about that anymore. It's literally, are you willing to live a countercultural life to your life being exploited and robbed of its humanity? And the kingdom takes on a new power and profundity now.
What's been the best day of your ministry and the worst day?
Wow. The worst day, I'll start there. The worst day was having a bipolar episode whilst preaching and walking off stage.
Wow.
And thinking my entire ministry had ended, and walking outside the front of the church and this kid on a skateboard going backwards and forwards. And I remember the panicked look on my leaders' faces as I just walked out of the building and sat outside on the curb, and just was, my brother came out and I just said, oh, see, I've done, I've blown it all up. I could just, it's over. That was definitely the worst day.
But you didn't blow it. It wasn't over.
It wasn't. And God used that to humble me, and it was a new beginning, and that was incredible. What is the best day? I don't have one particular best day. I see this as this story that I'm invited to. On Sunday, before I left, we baptized two guys, one who'd come from a Sri Lankan Buddhist background, one from a Persian Iranian background. Both found faith in Jesus. It's like a football season with many goals. There's not the one goal of the season. There may be one beautiful goal, but it's just the goals, and it's the points table. And God just continually is to unravel this story that I get the privilege to be part of. So it's not an event, it's a narrative.
How would you describe your calling?
I would say my calling is twofold. One is to be a pastor, and a father, and a parent, and a man of God in Melbourne, Australia. And the second one is to offer people a hopeful view of the kingdom of God, of what he wants to do in this intensified global moment, and interpreting and giving language to what's happening in the culture and how God wants to respond to this moment.
Sometimes it takes an outsider, not that you're an outsider, you're my friend now, it's all good. Yeah. But sometimes it takes someone from another place to come to a nation and to point out things that we here weren't aware of or hadn't noticed. So I'd love to hear from you, because, you know, you spent some time, quite a lot of time now here in the UK, meeting leaders, seeing what's going on. Who are the people or the ministries or, you know, the things that are happening that you're encouraged by, excited by, and learning from?
Yeah, I think there's a tremendous... Which just macro, I feel that it's really interesting. The country is being sort of shook a bit at the moment. Brexit and whatever side you come down on the divide, the foundations that were there, which seemed solid a few years ago, are dropping off. The era of Blairite Cool Britannia is not here anymore, and the Spice Girls and Oasis.
Oasis. How I miss those days, right? Were you Oasis or Blur? Because that was a big divide.
Oh, I liked both.
Okay.
You know, this sense that there's almost a humbling and an embarrassment, it feels. I feel that with people here, they're almost apologizing to me.
Right.
And what if this is a humbling that God's allowing? And what if, in a sense, you know, you walk around as an Australian, as the far reaches of the British Empire, and my city touched by that. What if God takes away a political, military, and economic empire and offers back a spiritual kind of influence that goes in both directions? So it's not one of triumphalism and domination, where West Africans come to London and Filipinos and Brazilians, and it goes in two directions. So I have this real sense, as I've been here this trip and last trip, that God actually, I think, wants to do something through the UK. I feel American church, in particular American evangelicalism, is going through a period of reckoning. And I feel like God is actually using some of the humility of the UK church as another counter voice within particularly in Anglosphere, the English-speaking church. I feel that there is this opportunity there for the church in Britain.
That's a wonderful place to leave it. Mark Sayers, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity magazine. And the magazine is also the place where you can read this interview with Mark Sayers. So if you enjoyed it and want to share it, you can share this as a podcast. Just go to premierchristianradio.com/theprofile to download it, or go to premierchristianity.com where you will find the written version of this interview. If you want to enjoy more great interviews like this one, you'll need to subscribe to Premier Christianity magazine, but you can get your first copy absolutely free if you go to premierchristianity.com/free sample. Simply put your address in and we will send you a free copy of the latest issue. My thanks to Mark Sayers for being this week's guest on The Profile. We'll be back same time, same place.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper. Distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.